Hello, Cachimbonas. Welcome to season 6 of Radio Cachimbona. Radio Cachimbona is an abolitionist podcast that audio archives state repression and fierce migrant resistance in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands and breaks down case law and politics from a leftist perspective. As the daughter of Salvadoran immigrants, Yvette prioritizes uplifting the voices and histories of Central Americans. That was certainly the case with this episode. I interview Jonathan Pedraza Campos, an educator and the program specialist at Teaching for Change's Teaching Central America program. We discussed what Teaching for Change and Teaching Central America consists of and why it was created. We discussed why Jonathan, along with Alejandra from Migrant Roots Media, decided to create a virtual course called Voces del Sur that is an ethnic studies course focused on Latinx experiences in the U.S. South, in the Global South, and is ultimately seeking to make connections between Latinxes in the U.S. South and the Global South more broadly. If you want to support the podcast, the best way to do so is to become a patron at patreon.com/radiocachimbona. If you do so, you'll get access to the Lit Review, which is a book club for cachimbonas. There are dozens and dozens of conversations with other women of color where we both share our insights into timely texts. This is an independently run podcast with no ads, and so the only way for the podcast to survive is for listeners to continue funding it. I do believe that being listener funded allows me to keep the political integrity of the podcast intact. With fascism rising, the number of trusted voices is diminishing, and it's up to us to invest in the people that we trust to continue putting information out there and to stop the spread of dis and misinformation. So I implore you, join the link in the episode show notes to become a Patreon. You can do it for as little as $3 a month, and you'll get access to bonus content, and you'll be fighting back against fascism. The other way that you can support the podcast that's 100% free is leaving an Apple Podcast or Spotify rating. You can also follow at Radio Cachimbona on Instagram, X, and Facebook. Before ending, I wanted to take a second to thank the latest Patreons who have joined the community, and that is Carla Ortiz and Justine Sleater. Thank you so much to you both. Like I said, the podcast would not exist. This podcast episode would not exist without folks like Justine and Carla supporting my work. Thank you so much. The support that you give me does not go unnoticed. It is something that is cherished and drives me forward to continue putting out more podcasts for you all to enjoy. That is it for now. I hope that you all enjoy this episode, and I'll catch you at the next one. Bye. Hello, Cachimbonas. Today, I am so excited to have Jonathan Pedraza Campos on the podcast today. We're going to be talking about Teaching for Change and their Teaching Central America program, as well as a course that he co-developed about that is an ethnic studies course focused on the Latinx experience in the U.S. South. But before we get more into it, I just wanted to introduce Jonathan to get the listeners more acquainted. He is an educator, the program specialist at Teaching for Change's Teaching Central America program, and a graduate student in education, history, and Latin American and Latinx studies. Based in the Buford Highway neighborhood of Metro Atlanta, Georgia, he has experimented with an ethnic studies of the global U.S. South in his middle school classroom and with programs like Escuelitas, raising questions of curriculum, pedagogy, and knowledge and cultural production that center the voices and praxis of racialized communities of the global U.S. South. At Teaching for Change, Veresa Campos supports the Teaching Central America program to equip teachers in schools across the country to teach Central American studies in kindergarten through 12th grade classrooms. He hopes to contribute to educational studies and Central American studies with his academic work about the global U.S. South. Before we get more into it, Jonathan, thanks so much for coming onto the podcast.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here with you.
To start, I wanted you to explain what is the Teaching Central America program within Teaching for Change and why was it created?
Yeah, so Teaching for Change, I think I want to start with that because to understand Teaching Central America, I think we have to go back to just a quick history of Teaching for Change. During the 80s, an organization ran by teachers started called NECA, the Network of Educators Committees with Central America. And a bunch of teachers in Washington, D.C., especially, and in other cities across the country were seeing that Salvadoran, Guatemalan, Nicaraguan, and other Central American youth were arriving in the 80s. And they were talking about these horrific stories of what was happening in their countries and to their families and all the worries and anxieties of these traumatic moments. And so these teachers wanted to help develop curriculum and develop content and have events and programming that helped other teachers and other community members have an understanding of why these youth were coming to their cities and becoming a part of their school communities, and why and how the U.S. government was very much involved in intervening in these countries, which led to these migrations to start happening from Central America. And so it was years of this work in NECA that eventually, after the peace accords were signed in the 90s, that's when NECA kind of shifted its focus to be more broadly social justice education. And it kind of changed its name to Teaching for Change. And so kind of the roots of Teaching for Change are the Central American Peace and Solidarity Movement and kind of getting teachers to be a voice, a curricular voice around what was happening in Central America. Since then, Teaching for Change has evolved to do all kinds of work in environmental justice, women's history, Black history, subversive histories. And of course, when we were hearing everything that was happening with the unaccompanied child minors a few years ago, and the discourse around Central American migration was starting back up in the 2010s, that's when Teaching for Change kind of got back to its roots of highlighting what was happening in Central America. And since then, Teaching Central America was born to help equip teachers in schools across the country and teaching the roots of migration from Central America and many other topics that centered Central American history and literature and voices in the curriculum for K-12 schools.
And how can teachers access these curriculum materials?
They can access Teaching Central America resources by going to teachingcentralamerica.org. And also Teaching for Change has a website. And so you can really access a lot of Teaching for Change's just broader materials about the Black freedom struggle. But Teaching Central America specifically has its own page where there are lessons free to download. We curate book, film lists, and all kinds of multimedia and artwork, and many, many other things for teachers to develop their own understanding of Central America and to find ways to bridge it in the classroom apart from our ready-to-go lesson plans that teachers can download.
That's exciting. Get into what Teach Central America Week is and what purpose it's meant to serve in K through 12 education?
Of course. Well, first of all, you know, we should not be teaching Central America in just one week of the year. You know, we should be teaching Central year round for sure. But definitely Teach Central America Week was kind of the flagship program from the Teaching Central America program that it falls in the first week of October every year since Teaching Central America kind of started. And it's really meant to recruit and promote the teaching of Central America during this week. And so we try to recruit teachers to sign up and pledge to teach about Central America during the first week of October every year. We, Teaching for Change and Teaching Central America put on events and programming during the week as well to kind of get teachers to learn more as well and know about the program. And other organizational partners, many of our advisors, also we get them to also do programming at their respective campuses, at university campuses or school campuses or their organizations, for them to host events as well. And so the idea is that, you know, let's take advantage of all the fervor behind Latinx Heritage Month in October, and let's get folks to really focus on Central America for this week. And it's kind of an entry point for folks to kind of find the strategic time to, yeah, use our lessons or create their own lessons. And then to send us teaching stories about how Teach Central America Week went. But we definitely encourage folks to, you know, use it as an entry point, but also to find other times and dates to keep teaching about Central America. And we always love to get teaching stories to our website about how Teach Central America Week went, or just teaching about Central America, so we can highlight the work that teachers are doing to really emphasize Central America in their classroom.
So it's, like you said, a starting point meant to encourage teachers to incorporate history and information about Central America in their teaching materials.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I also wanted to get into your specific project, creating an ethnic studies course focused on Latinx experiences in the U.S. South and Global South. What made you decide to create that course?
So I'm Central American. I'm Salvadoran and Guatemalan, born in Los Angeles. But I really grew up on the East Coast and in the South. I grew up in New York. Then we moved to Arkansas. And then we moved to Atlanta, Georgia. Because surprise, Latinos were everywhere. We've moved everywhere, including the U.S. South, especially the U.S. South in the last few years, where we've seen a lot of migration here. And so I think that me trying to learn to teach ethnic studies in the U.S. South, where I've been based most of my life, it really came from a desire to become the teacher that I wished I had growing up, because mm-hmm. I have been a student of California and Arizona and Texas and these other places where ethnic studies education has been growing because of so much amazing organizing. But Latinos and, of course, African-Americans, Indigenous peoples, Asian-Americans, we are also here in the South. And so, but at the same time, there isn't any infrastructure, or very little infrastructure, rather, for ethnic studies education in K-12. And not enough in higher education. And so the last few years, as I've been in grad school, I've really tried to teach myself a lot of ethnic studies pedagogy and curriculum, and especially Central American studies curriculum, because that's my main kind of research focus as a graduate student. And so the idea with starting, teaching ethnic studies in community organizations and in my school, where I'm a classroom teacher, but then starting the Voz del Sur program with Alejandra Mejia at Migrant Roots Media, all of this kind of came with the goal of really teaching our histories, and not just teaching our histories, but especially in the South, kind of developing, unraveling, producing our histories, producing our art and our narratives that haven't really been the focus of ethnic studies. And so the idea in all of my ethnic studies teaching, with my students and in Voz del Sur, where I teach with Alejandra, is that we are really trying to emphasize the U.S. South is a very dynamic place. It's not just the, you know, red, Republican, conservative, backwater, full of country folk and hillbillies. Like, it is many, many things, including some of that. But there is so much radical movement, so much revolutionary history that Black, Brown, Indigenous, Asian American, and many other folks have really done as early as the 1800s and before that and beyond. And so thinking about the global U.S. South from an ethnic studies and a Central American studies perspective is to emphasize, you know, we are here, but we're also here because the U.S. South and the global South are so interconnected over centuries in a way that we don't give enough credit to. And so we really try to emphasize things like, you know, the School of the Americas, which is a big part of Central American history. It is based in Georgia. It is based mm-hmm. in the South after relocating from Panama. And that is on purpose. We really try to center the School of the Americas, for example, as a Southern phenomena, that kind of spread its power, and is the reason why all of us from, you know, Salvador are here. William mm-hmm. Walker and Tennessee took over Nicaragua in 1856, right after the conquest of Mexico, right before the conquest of Puerto Rico. A Southern enslaver did that, right? And so the global U.S. South is something that is very ignored in ethnic studies and Central American studies. And the argument is, you know, we're here because of these very intimate connections that haven't had enough attention. And that's why we need to really develop and unravel our stories of being Southerners of the global South in the U.S. South.
Someone wanted to start reading at a very beginner level about ethnic studies pedagogy. What kind of stuff would you recommend that they look into?
I think that there's already some amazing resources that folks on the West Coast have produced. I really look at and have learned a lot from the work of the Raza Studies teachers in Tucson, Arizona. Mm-hmm. Watching a documentary, Precious Knowledge, and reading their work and going to their institutes like Chico, thinking about a Liberated Ethnic Studies Model Consortium in California, looking at Teaching for Changes resources that is very much grounded in ethnic studies, Teaching Central America included. There's a lot of beautiful work that's been done already, especially in places that have built the infrastructure, organized to build the infrastructure in the West Coast and in other places. So look at what already exists and use it. But in our Southern context, you know, where we don't really have that infrastructure, we're always reaching and learning from the folks that have. I think it's also important to learn from the greats and learn from the experts, but also acknowledge that we are also experts mm-hmm. of our experience, even though we don't have enough books about our experiences written, enough scholarship. There aren't enough classes that are part of our curriculum, even our universities. The idea of Wilson Sud, for example, was, you know, there is no Central American Studies of the South Forest. If it doesn't exist, let's be like the Freedom Schools, the Mississippi Freedom Schools, let's be like the Citizenship Schools, these other Southern models of education. Let's just start something that doesn't exist, but build what we don't have. But let's definitely take from ancestors, from predecessors who have a lot to teach us, while we adapt what they've created and make space for our own expertise and bringing our worlds together to build what doesn't exist yet so that others after us can continue to build on top of it.
You just mentioned the Freedom Schools. Is that a part of the revolutionary history of the South that you were mentioning that you and others that you work with draw inspiration from?
Absolutely. The Mississippi Freedom Schools from SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, they would bring teachers from the North. A lot of white teachers, but a lot of Black teachers too. They would build local Black teachers to lead these schools. There's also models like the Highlander Center in Tennessee, the Highlander Folk School, who trained Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks in organizing as a fact. There's a citizenship school in South Carolina led by Stephen Clark. But of course, Indigenous peoples, you know, they also have their own ways of knowing and teaching and learning in their own institutions. But also the ways that Latin Americans, Asian Americans in the South have built institutions. Part of that global U.S. South framework is that, you know, we as people of the global South that live in the U.S. South, let's pull from our ancestral practices. So for me, it's a lot of, you know, as a Central American, learning from the Nicaraguan literacy campaign, learning from the guerrillas and how they would practice popular education during the wartime in El Salvador and Guatemala. And bringing their perspectives and saying, you know, like, let's learn from the U.S. South model that Black and Indigenous folks have created. Let's also bring and cross-pollinate our global South models, like in Central America, to create the models that best serve our people in our global U.S. South context.
You already started explaining this a bit, but could you elaborate on the connections that there are between Latinxes in the U.S. South and Latin Americans more broadly? Or I guess the global South, because that's kind of, that's the terminology that you're using.
I mean, yeah, it's extensive. It's definitely extensive. I think if we think about the fact that the, you know, what we call now the United States, the East Coast, you know, it was British. It was British colonizers that kind of expanded westward. And then on the West Coast, there are more Spanish colonial roots there. Mm-hmm. But there were Spanish colonial roots in the U.S. South through Florida. Mm-hmm. Florida was the very first European colony on the continent. And the Spanish founded that while they were also building footholds on the West Coast. And Spanish was the first European language spoken, and it started in what we now call the U.S. South. And the misiones, the missions, right, were started there to assimilate and pacify the indigenous peoples of what we now call Florida and Georgia. And so the same colonizers were kind of trying to build footholds, you know, but, you know, the British and eventually they became the Americans, right? They expanded westward. The Southerners in particular, they wanted to expand plantation slavery to the West, which is why the Mexican-American War happened. Slavery and the expansion of slavery was a big reason for that. Just like the expansion of slavery was why William Walker in Nicaragua in 1856, he tried to develop foothold for slavery from the U.S. South in Nicaragua. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of those connections, thinking about indigenous conquest and thinking about chattel slavery and anti-blackness, and how these were some pivotal models for oppression of other people, including Latin Americans, that eventually arrived to the U.S. South. You can't think about labor exploitation in the United States and in the Global South without thinking about the OG labor exploitation model of chattel slavery, mm-hmm. Assimilation of language and de-indigenizing people, assimilating people, right? That happened in the South, that happened in the Global South. And they were talking to each other, these people across plantations, across colonies. They were collaborators. They were traders. They traded land, resources from that they extracted from that land, as well as people through the slave trade. And so I think that in thinking about the Global U.S. South and these connections with Latin Americans, Latinas in the South, like we're pointing to this bigger, broader ecosystem and networks, but also looking at the U.S. South as a very understudied, misunderstood and not understood place, when the argument is, you know, if we want to understand the prison industrial complex that is all over the country, all over, it's expanded even beyond the U.S. borders. It's huge in California, for example. If we want to understand those structures, let's come back to the South to understand how Southern ideologies and Southern structures around white supremacy, imperialism, colonialism. The South didn't create everything, of course, but some of the really deep roots of it. And of course, in modern day, right, like a lot of the Republican votes mm-hmm. and the most fascist governors are in the U.S. South, and that's for a reason that hold the entire country back. I think that those are the connections that I hope that a global U.S. South perspective can help us develop, so that we can have solidarity with the South across the country and with each other across the country and the world, to understand if we want to get free, let's work to liberate the South. Because W.E.B. Du Bois once said, as goes the South, so goes the nation. Mm-hmm. And so it's really about centering the South as a very oppressive space, but also a very revolutionary and radical space at the same time.
Right. So in this moment, you know, ethnic studies, critical race theory is under attack. Trump has passed multiple executive orders dismantling what he calls DEI. How have these efforts affected your work in Georgia? And in what ways are these sentiments affecting your project of trying to get more teachers to engage in this? I think I'm assuming it's an uphill battle, considering that's the landscape and you're still trying to convince teachers to adopt this and buy in.
The South, you know, is definitely worlds away from institutionalizing like Chicano studies, ethnic studies, Central American studies, the way that the West Coast has, the way mm-hmm. that Arizona, we are definitely not there. But we actually do permit schools to have African American studies, for example, and Latin American studies. Like schools or high schools are allowed to have that programming. But I think that because there really isn't the language of ethnic studies and There isn't a lot of expertise from teachers, a lot of training in our teacher programs around ethnic studies, the way that we've seen in California and Arizona and even Texas that has Mexican-American studies and Asian-American studies in their schools in certain places. We haven't gotten there yet, and there is a critical mass of teachers. And I don't think that it's because of a lack of trying. I think that Black teachers most definitely have built beautiful groundwork for ethnic studies through African-American studies in the South, this being the Black Belt of the country. For other ethnic studies fields, it's not as robust. There's definitely not that many Latino teachers. There's not that many Asian American, Indigenous teachers in the South and in Georgia where I'm at. And so it's harder when you don't have critical mass and you don't have people that have the language and have the political will to build that infrastructure. But of course, we are a region that has some of the harshest censorship policies already. Ethnic studies is being attacked right now in California. It was attacked in Arizona, where I got a lot of my initial understandings of ethnic studies. But Florida, for example, in the U.S. South, is a dream for the fascist educator, for the fascist governance. And it's here in the South, and they have set the tone, set the model for other states, including California, to be like, let's try what they're doing. They're doing things right. And it's really easy to do that here in the South because we live in the legacy of censorship. We live in the legacy of the plantation society, of empire building. And so the censorship laws we're seeing right now in places like Florida, like Georgia, and other states that are really banning or attempting to criminalize or attempting to limit and censor what teachers can and can't say, it has created a chilling effect in places like Georgia, but it's also just outright banned successfully in Florida. But at the same time, I think that we shouldn't rely on capital S schools, the school system to give us what we need. I think that if we look at the Freedom Schools and other institutions like that, we learn that our systems, they don't intend to serve us. They don't intend to liberate us. And so it is up to us to create the models and the infrastructure for the kind of schools we want our kids to go to. And so I'm really big on, let's try to be subversive in the school system. Let's kind of push against these policies, let's push against the censorship, because we can't just lay down and take it. We have to fight and be subversive and try to really crack open opportunities to build this in the traditional school system. But let's not just rely on the traditional school system. Let's build other spaces by us, for us, on our terms, where we are providing and developing the institutions and the education that we dream of. Because if we build it out here and we keep fighting in there, we've already done the work of visioning and dreaming up and practicing and refining what it is that we want to institutionalize in the school system. And so it's really about building these spaces and really pushing against kind of the fascism and the censorship that we have been seeing more and more in these last few years.
It's so important, especially in these times. And I know that with the Voces del Sur course, that is an example of something that is outside of schools with a capital S. The sessions happen on Zoom, right? How can folks become a student of that class if they're interested in it?
Well, we're actually planning right now, Ale and myself and our participants from the very, very first cohort that we launched this last year. It's been a year-long course. We just finished teaching, and right now we're working on final project. And so stay tuned at Migrant Roots Media on their social media, because we're going to have a showcase in June where our participants are going to present their final project to whoever wants to come and learn about Central American Studies of the South. It's in mid to late June, I believe. Come check out the showcase, see what we learn together, see what narratives and artwork about Central American Southerners that our participants have produced. And we will be kind of opening up and recruiting for a second cohort in due time. Stay tuned with Migrant Roots Media to learn about the next cohort opportunity, and come check out the showcase in June.
That's so exciting. I can't wait to check out the showcase.
Thank you. Me too. We're very excited.
How can people support Teaching for Change / Teaching Central America?
Definitely visit our website and sign up to receive newsletters from Teaching for Change and Teaching Central America on the different websites. To stay tuned about what resources we're producing, come to our programs. There's so many amazing programs from ZNED Project and Teaching for Change. To learn about the Black Freedom Struggle, for example, and learn about what resources we created around curriculum and lesson plans. Check out the websites, use them, join the different programs and the different study circles that Teaching for Change starts. Sign up for Teach Central America Week. And just keep engaging with our newsletters and with all the resources on the website and bring more people. Just keep teaching the truth and join our Teach Truth campaigns that we do every year to fight against censorship and book bans.
That's so amazing. Jonathan, the last question that I ask folks is, what is something that is inspiring you lately?
Something that is inspiring me lately. My students. I teach sixth grade. And I teach in a very brown, immigrant, but also a very diverse BIPOC community. And I have days of hopelessness and days of dread around what's happening. But then I remember that I have to be an adult and I have to be kind of an adult to young people who are also living and surviving this world. And so it really makes me teach the truth and teach ethnic studies with even more commitment, because these 11 and 12 and 13 year olds that are in my classroom right now, well, if they get the right curriculum, if their mind is allowed to open up and explore and make critical connections and understand who they are, where they come from, and what's happening to them, and what's been done before, and what we can do to continue fighting for our lives and our dignity in a different world, those kids, if they start now, they will grow up and become the people who will inherit the world, but also repair and transform the world that they will continue to live in for themselves and for the people after them. And so for me, the youth and the potential of the youth is what keeps me going and inspires me every single day.
I really feel that, because I just wrapped up teaching Latinx people in the law at UCLA Law School, and my students were also a constant source of inspiration and an antidote to the despair and dread that I feel whenever I look at the news cycle.
Oh, it's important, because I think we get jaded. We also get really jaded because, you know, we've lived longer on the earth and we've seen so much. Mm-hmm. And just a different energy, because and also a sense of possibility, but the goal is always hopefully that the generations that come after us push us through, the older we get, to think and engage in the world differently. And so definitely the kids, the youth, they know what's up.
Okay, Jonathan, well, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast, and I hope to have you back again soon.
Thank you so much. And yeah, I'm a big fan, big admirer of your work, and really grateful to share space with you.
Thanks. Bye, Kachimbona.